Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. It's easy to assume that other human beings think and feel, but what about a cow, a computer, a corporation? What kinds of mind do they have? We love some animals and we eat others. We debate the existence of God, and we fear the possibility of artificial intelligence becoming too intelligent, all of which relate to the moral dimensions of mind perception. Our guest on Pathways today is Kirk Gray, author of the new book, The Mind Club, Who Thinks, What Feels, and Why It Matters. Kurt is a professor of social psychology at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, who received his PhD from Harvard University. He studies mind perception and morality, pondering such questions as, what is the nature of good and evil? Can we ever truly know ourselves? Why are humanoid robots so creepy? And what makes grandma's cooking taste so good? Hello, Kurt, and welcome to the Pathways program.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
Now, this book lists a co-author who was your mentor, the late Daniel Wegener, and his contribution to psychology. And in fact, Steven Pinker called him among the world's cleverest, wittiest, and most beloved psychologists. Can you tell us about him and your collaboration with him?
Yeah, so I came to work with Dan Wegener in grad school in 2004. And actually the reason I went to work with him, not only because he had fantastic research, but because he managed to track me down while I was surfing in Australia. My phone rang one afternoon after picking grapes, and it was Dan Wegener, and he invited me to come explore the mysteries of the mind with him that next year, and I was delighted to do so.
And why did he invite you and pull you away from your surfboard?
I told him I wanted to go back to grad school at the end of the year, but I guess he liked my sense of humor, I think, most of all, and I think because he was born in Canada, he had a soft spot for Canadians, and I am Canadian.
I see. And so what did you do? What happened next?
So we started working together. He had a book about free will that I was interested in, but he was always looking at the next kind of new idea, and his next idea was about mind perception, how we understand the minds of others, especially those that are unclear, minds that he calls crypto minds. So things like animals and machines, and groups, and God, and the dead.
I see. So it was primarily about non-human minds.
Right. So psychology, mostly focuses on the human mind, and we do as well, but how the human mind perceives lots of other minds. We also have human minds in the book. So minds like the enemy and the beloved. So we often distort our perceptions of those we hate or love. And we cover those as well.
Okay. And so just one last question about the history of your evolution and how you came to write this book. So what was the work like? I mean, what is it like working for a research psychologist? Were you doing research? Were you doing polling? Were you having studies of people? How does that work? I'm just curious.
Yeah. So my grad school is really like an apprenticeship model, right? So Dan was kind of casting me in his own image. And so we would read and have discussions every week, and then I would design studies and then run them either, as you suggest, polling and surveys, or running lab studies or online studies. So we do a whole bunch of different things. The book is basically all the research that we've done together, and it's based upon our joint work. Mm-hmm. And he had wanted to write this book for a long time and finally started getting around to it once I had graduated in 2010 as with my PhD, and I became an assistant professor at Maryland at the time. And he had written the proposal for the book and then realized that he had ALS, which was sad news for everyone. And he realized that he probably didn't have enough time to finish the book.
I see.
Or at least might not. And so he asked me if I might help him finish. And he's a very witty guy. And he said, look, I know as an assistant professor, you've got lots of things to do, like write papers and write grants, and books don't count for tenure, really. So as your advisor, I'd have to say that you should say no to this request. But it's a last request from a dying man. Could you help me finish the book?
That's a pretty compelling request.
Pretty compelling, yes. Obviously, I said yes.
Okay. Hey, well, let's get into the subject matter. What is a mind? What is your definition of mind?
Oh, boy. So I think my definition of mind is whatever you and your listeners think a mind is. So, you know, philosophers have tried for a long time to objectively define a mind. But really, I think minds are in the eye of the perceiver. And so minds are really what people perceive them to be. And our work suggests that people perceive minds as following two different dimensions, one for thinking and one for feeling. And that kind of discovery that we perceive minds along these two different dimensions contradicts, in some ways, centuries of thoughts about how we understand the mind. So,
well, we know that there are different parts of the brain. Like there's the limbic brain and there's the neocortex. Does this map against that, this thinking and feeling distinction?
I'd say it's more. It's kind of like more higher level, so kind of constructed.
Uh-huh.
So, St. Thomas Aquinas used to say that there is this great chain of being, right, that starts with rocks and then plants and then animals and then humans and then angels and then God. So mind was thought as along this like this giant continuum. And certainly it's true that, you know, humans are both good thinkers and feelers. We have both senses of mind and rocks have neither. But the fact that these things can come apart in our perceptions, thinking and feeling, makes it really interesting to perceive some minds. So like puppies are perceived to be really good at feeling and not so good at thinking. And corporations and machines are perceived to be good at thinking, but not so good at feeling. And yeah.
Now, in these days, you know, there's a strain of scientific reductionism which has gained popularity. And it forces me to ask this question. What's the difference between mind and brain chemistry?
So I think they're clearly related, and I think that the mind comes out of the brain. But the fact that we intuitively separate the mind from the brain, so the fact that all of us are really intuitive dualists, has a lot of implications for perceiving the mind, right? So this is why we can perceive the minds of the dead, for instance, even though their bodies have passed away, because right, we perceive the mind as persisting even after the body has disappeared.
Does the concept of mind imply life after death?
I think how we traditionally understand that it does, and I think it's easy for us to imagine the mind persisting after death. I mean, the separation of mind and body, you know, in our perceptions is very apparent when you consider movies like Freaky Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And the shows that are like that. I mean, it's trivial for us to imagine that you and I, you know, switched minds, our minds switched bodies, right? That's actually a really complicated idea, you know, dealing with all sorts of shifting identities. But we're very facile with that idea because we think that minds are distinct and encapsulated.
Now, do you have a concept of what might be called a properly working mind?
Not really. Can you give me more?
Well, I'm just wondering, is there any kind of prescription or prescriptive idea that you might have for human beings in terms of governing or using their mind?
I think our most kind of prescriptive take home from the book is that, you know, we should be trying to perceive minds more in other people. Especially those who are different from us. So we often perceive others who are similar to us to have the same thoughts and feelings, and we welcome them into the moral circle. But those who are different from us, so foreigners or immigrants or Muslims, right? We think that they have fundamentally different minds and maybe fundamentally deserve less moral status than ourselves.
In chapter one, actually presents the quote problem of other minds, and that's what you're talking about here, right?
Exactly. Right. So because each of us are trapped within our own minds, right? We are minds. We can never directly experience the minds of others. And so, right, one thought experiment is the matrix, right? How do you know you're not in the matrix? You're not the only mind surrounded by a sea of computer-generated others. You can't ever really know with certainty. And so with other minds, we kind of need a leap of faith. And we just perceive that they're there.
And what do you mean by Mind Club? The title of the book is The Mind Club. What is that?
So the Mind Club is just that collection of entities that we allow the capacity in some sense to think and feel. So because we can never know for certain, it's we kind of extend minds to others as a gift. We invite them in the mind circle with us, in the mind club. And then once they're in the club with us, once we acknowledge that they can think and feel, again, we give them certain moral standing. So those in the mind club are minds and deserve protection from harm, but those outside the mind club are just things and they can be bought and sold. So slavery was justified on the basis that enslaved peoples don't have the same minds as the people doing the enslaving.
Right. So that's why disagreements about who's in the club lead to such level of conflict.
Certainly. I mean, one need only to look at the topic of abortion to
Right.
recognize this. So I think, both pro-choice and pro-life people, they agree that babies are deserving of protection and that we shouldn't kill babies, but I think what they fundamentally disagree on is mind perception. So
Right,
whether a
exactly. Yeah,
developing mass of cells has a mind or doesn't.
or when does it have a mind? In
Exactly.
other words, what is the definition of a baby?
Right, exactly.
As a, yeah.
And it's complicated because, we can all perceive the future, and so when you have a 10-week-old fetus, we don't only perceive the fetus as it is, a little, speck in the womb, but also the child will become someday and maybe will become president, et cetera.
Right. So there's a hazard to this kind of future tripping, isn't there? I mean, we have this ability to imagine the future or predict the future, but in a way, there's a downside to that because it influences our perception of the present.
Yeah, and I think in some ways that's completely justified, right? Because if you just leave a baby alone long enough, it will become a person.
Right.
But certainly, we have to disentangle the factual per, you know, the facts of mind from our perceptions. We can do it with animals as well, kind of what we wish to believe and what's actually there. So,
Now, I.
the classic thing is pet owners. So
Right.
pet owners think that their pet is probably more brilliant than the 5-year-old children of their neighbors, right? Even though it
Right.
eats its own poop.
And they think their kids are better looking.
Right, exactly.
So,
Exactly.
yeah, now the chapters of the book are interesting. They're about all these different kinds of minds, and you've. Can you tell us how you broke that down and came up with the chapters and how you divided it up? Is there any kind of like logical progression?
I wouldn't say a logical progression. It's more kind of like the Odyssey. So we wanted to start a journey, start out at home and then travel the seas of mind perception and just go to all the interesting minds. It's just like, when you go to the zoo, you're going to stop by the tigers and the elephants and maybe the snakes. And so we wanted to have a kind of zoo trip of minds, go around and do the most interesting ones. But there is a kind of unifying theme to them. Again, it's the idea that these are the minds that are most ambiguous and most important. And most often, the minds where the ability to think and the ability to feel come apart.
And how is it that a non-biological entity, like a corporation, for instance, can have a mind?
On one hand, again, it's really about perception. And certainly people perceive corporations like Google as having a mind. So we think it makes sense to say, you know, Google's intending to do X. Google is planning to launch this new product. And that makes sense to people. Of course, it doesn't make sense to say that Google's feeling hungry right now or sexually aroused.
Right.
So we only give a kind of mind to Google. The idea of group minds are incredibly interesting. And maybe this is a bit of a head trip, but in some sense, all minds come out of groups. So you asked about mind and brain. Well, really, the brain is just a group of dumb things, neurons, that whose interaction altogether makes a mind, right?
Right.
And so when you look at groups, things like Google or the example we use in the book is the United States of America, you can wonder, is the United States of America a conscious thing? Is the collection of all of us people interacting together, does that make the United States conscious? Is like the US talking to Canada in some higher level language we don't understand? I mean, there's like an immune system and a circulation system, which are our roads, and right? I mean, there's all these things, and we just can't know because we're trapped in our own minds.
Well, it seems pretty unconscious to me. But okay, what about animals? They are perceived to be on a par with humans in terms of experience, but how deeply can animals really feel?
People, at least, believe that animals can feel as deeply as humans. They can feel pain and pleasure. We believe they can feel a deep kind of love towards us. But again, it's not clear if it's the same kind of love. So, right, there's stories of cats who ostensibly love their owners, and then their owners die in their house, and then their cat eats their body.
But maybe that's an act of love for them.
That's true. Maybe it's an act of love. But I think the questions of whether animals can feel are really important for things like animal rights. So vegetarians typically perceive a much richer mind in animals than do meat eaters. Right, and that makes sense. So there's a fun study that we talk about in the book where researchers approached people at a grocery store and then gave them either cashews or beef jerky. And then they had them rate the mental capacities of cows. And if you just had beef jerky, then you're liable to think that cows are incredibly stupid.
That's funny.
Because you don't want to be the kind of person that eats a mind.
I see. Okay, so we're actually very sensitive to what has a mind or what doesn't have a mind. It makes a huge amount of difference. That comes through in your book time and time again.
So I should say that with animals, it's funny, though, in that we often confuse what looks like it has a mind with what actually has a mind. So crows are actually incredibly smart. They understand basic physics in a way that sometimes even children don't.
Who is that?
Crows.
Crows, oh yeah.
Yeah. So they can solve like hydraulics problems and make staircases to get at ants in depressions.
Right.
And most of us don't feel any compunction about harming a crow, right, or shooting a crow if it's a pest. But it could be that crows are actually smarter than kittens, and certainly people get upset if you harm a kitten. The same is true with pigs versus puppies. So, you know, a full-grown pig is actually very smart, but most of us don't feel any compunction eating bacon while we talk to our puppies.
Right, right. And why do we talk to our puppy?
Well, I think mind perception is, in some sense, promiscuous, and it's just easy when we perceive other minds to think of them as human, right? Because we're human, and
right,
our template for minds is human, and so when we think of things like animals or even our cars, sometimes we do what's called anthropomorphize,
right?
Treat an animal as if it has the same human, you know, capacity for personality and embarrassment and nostalgia, right? I think people attribute richer minds to their pets than they do to other people.
Well, we kind of do that in religion too. I mean, we talk to God and or Jesus or Buddha, or isn't that kind of the same thing?
It certainly is, yeah. So religion's kind of paradoxical in some sense, because we often talk about God as completely unknowable and powerful and beyond the ken of human comprehension. And yet we often think of God as just like this old dude who's sitting up in the sky who looks exactly like us, right?
Right. That's right. We personalize it.
Yeah. And there's some good research that suggests that we create God in our own image, often more than vice versa. And so if you think that God is, if you are pro, let's say, marijuana legalization, then you think God is definitely pro marijuana legalization.
Oh, I think they have it in heaven, probably.
Probably. I mean, that's heaven without a little marijuana.
Anyway, let's talk about the evolution of the machine and how human inventions have become what you call crypto minds.
Yeah, so machines are really this amazing case study in mind perception, because machines are a product of the human mind that people then in turn perceive. So as we get more and more sophisticated, right, we move from vacuum cleaners that you move around with a stick to things like Roomba that go on their own and have some semblance of intelligence. And we're getting sophisticated robots that can kind of give medicine and even kind of touch our heartstrings. So at MIT, there's a robot that looks just like an Ewok from Star Wars. Its name is Leonardo. And when people interact with this robot, they treat it like a kid. Right? When Leonardo gets sad, they get sad. And when Leonardo gets happy and smiles, they think it's the greatest thing.
Right. And what? But why do most humanoid robots seem so creepy?
Yeah, so there's this old idea in robotics called the Uncanny Valley. And it was created by this roboticist named, last name of Mori, this Japanese roboticist in the 70s. And what he predicted was that people like robots, the more they look human-like and lifelike, up to a point. And then they get really creepy when they're too human, but not quite. And so this is called the valley, because it's a steep decline in liking when they get close to being human.
Okay, go ahead.
So this is why, if you've seen the movie The Polar Express with Tom Hanks, he seems so creepy because he's like almost human, but not quite there. Mm-hmm. And the explanation for this, I think, is that when people see these kind of robots, they make us attribute the capacity for feeling, for emotion. And that's a capacity that fundamentally we believe is often off limits to robots. So.
And you said something about their eyes too.
Right. So it's often creepy because they have these dead kind of flat gray eyes. And the specialness of the eyes is that the eyes are what connote our emotions, right? So we cry when we're upset from our eyes, and we, you know, crinkle them when we smile and all sorts of things. And so when they have these human eyes that don't quite look human-like but are clearly robots, it seems like these robots can feel, but a kind of strange, bizarre robot kind of feeling that no one wants to imagine, right? So we're happy for robots to make cars and help us with our medication and keep our house 72 degrees, but we don't want them, you know, obsessing over or lusting after our wife or trying to marry our daughter.
Okay, so at the beginning of the show, I brought up a few questions that your book addresses, and it's interesting that you lead what's called the Mind Perception and Morality Lab at UNC, right?
That's right.
Okay, so I want to ask the question that was posed at the beginning. What is the nature of good and evil?
Yeah, so we often think of good and evil as these kind of forces, these real forces in our lives. And we argue in the book that you can kind of get good and evil for free just by combining different kinds of minds. So to be more specific, You know, when we think of evil, we typically think of a person whose thinking causes another person's feeling or suffering. Things like assault and murder, right? They fit these, like, there's a thinker harming a feeler. When corporations have child laborers, it's a kind of thinking thing, right, causing suffering. And this template of morality lets us kind of predict our moral outrage and understand when we're going to pass moral judgment. And so the more powerful the thinker who does something, and the more deep the feeler who receives it, the stronger our moral outrage. So if you think of a CEO punching a little girl in the face, you get pretty upset. But if you think of a little girl kicking a CEO, well, now it's kind of funny, right? Maybe it's on America's Funniest Home Videos. This allows us, this kind of template, to predict all sorts of moral judgments across different domains. So this is why we get so upset when people harm puppies and when people harm animals, especially when corporations do it, because corporations are seen as only thinkers and puppies are seen as only feelers. But when we reverse it, we don't get the same reaction. And in fact, this template is so powerful that we, in some sense, see it even when it doesn't exist. So if we feel like we've been harmed, even randomly, so a natural disaster, or we just slip and fall on the sidewalk, it's not enough to just to say, well, I was unlucky. We have to think that there's a thinker to blame for our suffering. And so this is why when people, you know, trip and fall or spill hot liquids on themselves, we sue Starbucks, or we sue a homeowner for not scraping off a sidewalk. And this is why when things are really bad after natural disasters, we often look to governments. So we blame FEMA for hurricanes, or in some cases, of course, God, the ultimate moral agent.
Right, but we've got to blame somebody. And that sort of explains the scapegoating phenomenon we're seeing arise during this current election cycle. Hey, well, thank you, Kurt. We could certainly talk a lot longer, but we've pretty much run out of time. We do have enough time to tell our listeners about your website, however. So please give us the domain name and tell us what we could find there.
Yeah, so my website is at www.kurtjgray.com. So KURTJGRAY. And there you can find a link to the book. You can find a link to my papers. You can find a pretty intuitive and accessible summary of my research, and a link to some other writing that I've done as well.
Well, thanks again, Kurt. There's so many more topics out of the book that we could have discussed and that we're not able to get to, but I really appreciate you being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
And for those who tuned in late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of the Pathways show, which is called Personal and Cultural Evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this entire interview anytime you want via podcast on the internet or via iTunes. Today, we have been visiting with Kurt Gray, author of the new book, The Mind Club, Who Thinks, What Feels, and Why It Matters. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pathways interview program, which is broadcast and streamed via KBOO.FM on Sunday mornings at 8:30 a.m. USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, that's spelled divination.com, on iTunes, and via the website kboo.fm. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways and its podcasts. And thanks again to Kurt Gray and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways experience.